Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1139. The 2001 anthrax attacks, the invasion of Iraq, and the expansion of biological warfare capabilities. This is being recorded on July 13th of the year 2020. I am taking a slight detour from the subject that I have been covering for some months, namely the COVID-19 outbreak, although the discussion of this, or the discussion in this program, is directly related to things underlying the analysis being presented in this ongoing series, or in the ongoing series about the COVID-19 outbreak. In For the Record program number 1128, we examined the possibility that the milieu of the Project Coast apartheid era South African biological warfare program and intersecting elements with the U.S. biological warfare program may have been involved with vectoring New York City with the coronavirus. It is a long discussion. I can appreciate that that will seem crazy to some people, but I would encourage people to examine the presented the documentation, because that, the hypothetical argument rests on that. Now, in this program, we are going to revisit some of the elements that we looked at in that program. In particular, an article from Vanity Fair magazine from October of 2003 called "The Message in the Anthrax," authored by Don Foster. Now, what we are going to be doing in this program is examining some aspects of the 2001 anthrax attacks, and we will be examining them in the context of sort of a dual provocation. Ultimately, the anthrax attacks were laid at the door of a gentleman named Bruce Ivins, last name I-V-I-N-S. He was an employee at Fort Detrick, a biological warfare specialist. He committed suicide, or allegedly committed suicide, and the anthrax attacks were hung around his neck. Although I'm not going to read it into the record in this program, it will be in the written description for the program in the book Bitten by Chris Newby that we looked at in For the Record programs 1135, 1136, and 1137. Ms. Newby interfaces and networks with a number of biological warfare veterans or program veterans from the U.S. BW program. In discussion with some of them, they voiced their opinions that their former colleague Bruce Ivins had been framed for the anthrax attacks. We are going to be looking at the anthrax attacks. I personally have my doubts that the unfortunate late Bruce Ivins was the lone nut that he is alleged to have been. I think the anthrax attacks, in all probability, were a provocation aimed at one level, providing some of the background to, or some of the supporting disinformation in order to justify the invasion of Iraq. I think also another and perhaps more significant long-term motive for this provocation was to justify an expansion of the U.S. biological warfare program, or biodefense program as it has been euphemized. As I have noted in the past, the distinction between offensive, unquote, and, quote, defensive, unquote, biological warfare research is essentially academic. If you are investigating how we beasties, bacterium, viruses, etc., infect people, plants, or animals and make them sick, the research is the same, whether it is, quote, offensive, unquote, or, quote, defensive, unquote. Following the 2001 anthrax attacks, I think some of them actually occurred in 2000, very early 2002, but following those attacks, there was a tenfold increase in the funding for biological warfare or biodefense or offensive capabilities. I believe, again, that the anthrax attacks were in all probability a provocation aimed at, again, justifying the invasion of Iraq and also to serve as the foundation, the justification for a massive expansion of the U.S. biological warfare capability. Now, we're going to begin examining this hypothesis by reviewing some sections of an article that I have used many times. It is from the Last American Vagabond blog of January 30th, 2020 by Whitney Webb, W-E-B-B, that is a woman, and it is titled Bats, Gene Editing, and Bioweapons. Recent DARPA experiments raise concerns amid coronavirus outbreak, and discussing some of the disinformation about China having allegedly produced the virus, the coronavirus, as part of their biological warfare program. And we will come back, perhaps in the future program, to deeper discussion of Radio Free Asia, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, and something that I believe was a foundation for not only the full court press against China, but really sort of something that might be called the Earth Island Boogie, as I have termed it in past programs, or perhaps the full court press or the Earth Island Op. We will be talking in that one about WikiLeaks, about the escapades of Edward Snowden and some of those things in that context. However, diving into this Whitney Webb article, we're going to be taking a look at the role of the Washington Times, that is owned by the Unification Church, which appears to be a Korean iteration of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies that basically propelled Japan into World War II and have remained a foundation of Japanese ultranationalism and fascism in the post-World War II period. Again, Washington Times, owned by the Unification Church. And in the Last American Vagabond article by Whitney Webb, she notes the role of the Washington Times, as well as Radio Free Asia, in not only promoting disinformation about China and the coronavirus, but also their past role, the Washington Times' past role, that is, in helping to generate the Saddam Hussein was behind the 2001 anthrax attacks as well. Again, from that, gene editing and bioweapons, recent DARPA experiments raise concerns amid coronavirus outbreak by Whitney Webb, we read. With Radio Free Asia and its single source having speculated about Chinese government links to the creation of the new coronavirus, the Washington Times soon took it much further in a report titled, Virus Hit Wuhan Has Two Laboratories Linked to Chinese Biowarfare Program. That article, much like Radio Free Asia's earlier report, cites a single source for that claim, former Israeli military intelligence biowarfare specialist Danny, D-A-N-Y, Shoham, S-H-O-H-A-M. Yet upon reading the article, Schoen does not even directly make the claim cited in the article's headline, as he only told the Washington Times that, quote, certain laboratories in the Wuhan Institute have probably been engaged in terms of research and development in Chinese biological weapons, at least collaterally, yet not as a principal facility of the Chinese BW alignment. While Schoen's claims are clearly speculative, it is telling that the Washington Times would bother to cite them at all, especially given the key role he played in promoting false claims that the 2001 anthrax attacks were the work of Iraq's Saddam Hussein. Schoen's assertions about Iraq's government and weaponized anthrax were used to bolster the case for the 2003 invasion of Iraq and have since been proven completely false. And as we're going to see in an article again called The Message in the Anthrax by Don Foster from the October 2003 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, we're going to be taking a look at the anthrax attacks and how, among others, Stephen Hatfield, initially focused on as a suspect in the anthrax attacks and ultimately acquitted for his role among the targets of those anthrax attacks, was U.S. Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont, and he opined that if in fact Bruce Ivins, the alleged lone nut perpetrator of the anthrax attacks, was involved, that he was not the only person involved. I would note that the, quote, investigation, unquote, of the 2001 anthrax attacks was done by, drumroll fanfare, Robert Mueller, who was head of the FBI at that time, and he has served as an intelligence fixer in many respects in many investigations, the invasion of Panama and Manuel Noriega, the Pan Am 103 bombing, the BCCI investigation, and he also helped to cover up the Operation Green Quest investigation in connection with the 9/11 attacks as well. Very interesting fellow, Mr. Mueller. But as we get into the article about the 2001 anthrax attacks, take a look at how Stephen Hatfield has cropped up in connection with or tangential to many of not only the anthrax attacks, but some of the related incidents. There was an incident in Wichita in which an alleged white supremacist group engaged in bioterrorism, and that was sort of shoved under the rug. There was an incident in Louisiana shortly after Stephen Hatfield showed up in Louisiana. There was a Mr. Assad who had been working at the USAMRIID at Fort Detrick. He left following casting aspersions on him because of his Arabic background. His place at USAMRIID was taken by Stephen Hatfield. There was a call from an alleged FBI agent in Louisiana to Mr. Assad that appeared to be from someone who had access to his file from his work at USAMRIID. And this was not, however, an FBI agent. It is a crime to imitate or to pretend to be an FBI agent. Stephen Hatfield crops up in many different contexts in connection with the 2001 anthrax attacks. And also in connection with the search for Saddam Hussein's biological warfare weapons, which served as part of the justification for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Note that as Don Foster, who was a professor of English at Vassar College and whose literary skills had basically propelled him into a role as an advisor to the FBI on notes that were submitted in connection with various terrorist incidents, in particular the 1996 Olympics bombing. As Don Foster developed information that pointed in the direction of Stephen Hatfield. He did not come up with information to convict, obviously. Hatfield was acquitted. But note how there is an apparent unwillingness on the part of the investigative establishment of this country to look into Stephen Hatfield. In other words, he seems to have a sort of a Teflon slash get out of jail free card that permits him to escape the investigative focal point or investigative spotlight, so to speak, in connection with the anthrax attack. So as we revisit a long excerpt of this article, again, The Message in the Anthrax by Don Foster, Vanity Fair magazine, October of 2003, note how Stephen Hatfield, whom I suspect is actually an agent of one or another intelligence service in this country, CIA being the most probable, but not by no means the only one. Note how, despite information pointing in the direction of Stephen Hatfield, he appears to be made of Teflon. He appears to have a get-out-of-jail-free card, and that information just slides off his persona. Note the number of different contexts in which Stephen Hatfield crops up in connection with incidents that have served to bolster the preparation or defense against biological warfare in this country. And again, the difference between offensive and defensive biological warfare is essentially academic. Note how many different contexts Stephen Hatfield crops up in connection with the invasion of Iraq and Saddam Hussein's biological warfare weapons, which, as indicated in that Whitney Webb article, were one of the justifications for the Iraq invasion. Notice also that Stephen Hatfield's mentor, Bill Patrick, perhaps the alpha researcher into biological warfare in this country, or the alpha biological warfare scientist in this country's biological warfare program. He died of cancer in 2010, but he was the main man, so to speak, and he was the mentor to Stephen Hatfield. They were described as a Batman and Robin type team. Now note that in 1999, Bill Patrick forecast that the U.S. would be hit within 2 years by a biological warfare attack using a sophisticated agent manufactured overseas. That was 2 years before the 2001 anthrax attacks. And note that the extremely skilled preparation that was used in those anthrax attacks, and they used the Ames, A-M-E-S, strain of anthrax, which is the strain that was used by the U.S. biological warfare program. Note that the anthrax powder that was sent in the 2001 anthrax attacks was refined to a trillion spores per gram. And that was a degree of refinement that Bill Patrick had achieved and that was way beyond the capabilities of Iraq, South Africa, or the Soviet Union. So again, from The Message in the Anthrax, Built by, BG, by the way, is a harmless simulant of an anthrax powder concoction. Patrick's BG sample was purified to a trillion spores per gram, near the theoretical limit and better than anything ever produced by Iraq, South Africa, or the Soviet Union. An untrained eye could not differentiate it from the anthrax powder that Patrick had produced in 1959. The purpose of the exercise at Dugway Proving Ground, Utah, however, was defensive, to prepare our nation for a bioterror attack. In April of 1999, Patrick told Fox News that in 2 years, there will be an attack with a sophisticated agent manufactured overseas. His prediction was not far off the mark. By October 12th, 2001, the press was reporting that Bob Stevens, S-T-E-V-E-N-S, the 63-year-old tabloid photo editor at American Media Incorporated in Boca Raton, Florida, who had mysteriously succumbed to inhalational anthrax on October 5th, had been infected at work. Inhalational anthrax comes from breathing in spores and is far deadlier than the cutaneous form of the disease, which is usually contracted through cuts and scratches in the skin. Spores were found throughout the AMI building, with hot spots in the mailroom and on the victim's keyboard. Powder samples from both the Tom Brokaw and Tom Daschle letters, that was former broadcaster Tom Brokaw and U.S. Senator Tom Daschle. Again, powder samples from both the Brokaw and Daschle letters were couriered to Fort Detrick headquarters of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, or USAMRIID, in Frederick, Maryland. The U.S. AMRIID scientists were alarmed by what they discovered. It was the same stuff that had killed Bob Stevens, the tabloid photo editor in Florida. The Ames strain used in the U.S. biodefense program. The distribution of Ames, regulated by U.S. AMRIID, was limited to about a dozen labs under tight security controls. Moreover, the anthrax had been weaponized, refined to its most lethal particle size of 1 to 3 microns. Most astonishing was its purity. The powder had been concentrated to a trillion spores per gram. In November, and by the way, that is precisely the purity that had been achieved by Bill Patrick, and it was sort of a nonpareil standard. It was arguably the go-to standard for an anthrax preparation. So the fact that he was able to do that, and then in April of 1999, Patrick tells Fox News that, again, in 2 years there will be an attack with a sophisticated agent manufactured overseas. Then 2 years later, there are several anthrax attacks using the Ames strain peculiar to the U.S. BW, or used by the U.S. BW program, and that it has been refined to a trillion spores per gram, better than anything Saddam Hussein had been able to do. In November of 2001, some of the West's top bio-warriors converged on Swindon, S-W-I-N-D-O-N, England, for an advanced training course for the United Nations Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission. One of the big names on hand for the conference was Stephen J. Hatfield, a former U.S. AMRIID virologist and a protege of Bill Patrick's. Those who completed the course and were certified would have a chance to join the search for Saddam's bioweapons in Iraq. New USAMRIIB hires that year, following Assad. Again, he was an Egyptian-born researcher at USAMRIIB, but a number of employees there cast aspersions on him because of his background. He was obliged to leave. When he left, his place was taken by Stephen J. Hatfield. Beginning again. New USAMRIIB hires that year, following Assad's departure, included Stephen J. Hatfield, a recruit from the National Institutes of Health. Hatfield was a concept man with a detailed vision for building mobile germ laboratories. Assad, meanwhile, took a job with the EPA, where he now works as a toxicologist testing pesticides. It was while looking for information on the B'nai B'rith incident that I found a Washington Times interview with Stephen Hatfield, then a virologist with the National Institutes of Health, who was said to have, quote, thought carefully about bioterrorism, unquote. The Washington Times paraphrased Dr. Hatfield's explanation of the four levels of possible biological attack. Now, note again, this is the Washington Times, which also featured Danny Shoham's assertions that Saddam Hussein was behind the 2001 anthrax attacks. Of Stephen Hatfield's four levels of biological attack, the first is the B'nai B'rith variety in which no real organisms are used. Quote, hello, this is Abdul. We have put anthrax in the food at Throckmorton Middle School, unquote. In fact, Abdul hasn't. We empty public buildings for bomb threats. How about for anthrax threats, unquote. After all, sooner or later, one might be real. The second level consists in the release of real bacteria, but without the intention of infecting many people. Probably only a few people would get it, and perhaps none would die. The third level consists in trying to get a lot of people sick and maybe dead. Anthrax spores put into the ventilation system of a movie theater would do the trick. The result would be horrendous panic, even if only 100 people got sick or died. The fourth level consists of a self-sustaining, unstoppable epidemic. How hard, really, would it be to carry out a bioattack? Not very, Hatfield said. Culturing bacteria is easy and almost universally understood. Now note again the role of the Washington Times. They have a magazine called Insight, INSIBHT. And once again, before the anthrax attacks in January of 1998, they featured Stephen Hatfield, sort of foreshadowing the possibility of biological warfare attack on the U.S. And Don Foster writes, searching further, I learned that the B'nai B'rith episode occurred a few months after mysterious gas incidents at Washington National Airport, now Reagan National Airport, and Baltimore-Washington International Airport. On both occasions, passengers were overcome with noxious fumes that were not publicly identified by investigators. 10 months later, people again fell ill at Washington National and had to be hospitalized after reporting those fumes. In January of 1998, after the third airport incident in a year, the Washington Times magazine Insight published a second interview with Hatfield, who said, quote, these types of incidents could be a form of testing for a possible future terrorist attack, perhaps next time using anthrax, unquote. This ominous commentary was accompanied by a photograph of Hatfield at home in his kitchen wearing garbage bags, gloves, and an army supply gas mask, illustrating how a bioterrorist might cook up bubonic plague in a private laboratory and cause havoc using a homemade spray disseminator such as the one Hatfield had designed himself. All of which seemed to me an unusual hobby for a virologist then employed by the National Institutes of Health. Parenthetically, NIH has served as a cooperating agency with both CIA and the Pentagon in DW research. Now, note this again. This article is in January of 1998, and Stephen Hatfield is warning about the possibility that there could be a terrorist attack using anthrax. Returning now to Don Foster's article. Then I found another interesting news item. Shortly after the Washington Times Insight published its ghoulish photograph of Hatfield in his home laboratory, a white male wearing a gas mask deposited a bottle outside the U.S. Treasury building. An anonymous call was then placed alerting the U.S. Secret Service that it contained, quote, liquid chemical warfare agent, unquote. The bottle, though found, was not preserved. It was, after all, just a hoax, unquote. In this interview with Hatfield, Insight reported that he had worked in Zimbabwe in the late 1970s when, quote, an epidemic of anthrax from natural causes affected 10,000 people, unquote. In fact, Hatfield had been in apartheid Rhodesia from 1978 to 1980, the year it was renamed Zimbabwe, and witnessed the worst outbreak of anthrax ever recorded in the part of Africa where anthrax was rarely encountered. During the civil war to topple the apartheid government, the Southern Tribal Trust lands were ravaged by an epidemic that caused 10,738 recorded human infections in about 2 years. Today, black Zimbabweans and their livestock are still becoming ill and dying from the biological fallout. That the outbreak was, quote, natural, unquote, is debatable. In 1992, Dr. Merrill Nass, M-E-R-Y-L, last name N-A-S-S, an American physician, and Jeremy Brickhill, a Zimbabwean journalist, published separate reports supporting what was already suspected, that the Rhodesian anthrax epidemic was deliberate, a bio-warfare attack on the black townships, probably carried out by Rhodesia's notorious government-backed SELUS scouts, militia, but the SELUS is S-E-L-O-U-S. In January of 2002, while compiling documents by and about Hatfield, including his unclassified scientific publications, I found a brief autobiography. In it, Hatfieldville American boasted of having served in the late 1970s with the SELUS scouts in Rhodesia. In that same brief bio, Dr. Hatfield indicated that he had taken his medical degree from the Godfrey Huggins School of Medicine in Harare, Rhodesia, which he attended from 1978 to 1984. Next, I searched the internet for a Greendale school somewhere in Africa and discovered the Courtney Sellis School, situated in the wealthy white Harare suburb of Greendale, a mile from the medical school where Hatfield spent 6 years obtaining his MD while serving by his own unconfirmed account with the SELUS scouts. By the way, as we looked at in For the Record 642, and as we came back to in For the Record 1128, Hatfield was also a member of white Afrikaner resistance. Returning to Don Foster's article, Stephen Hatfield was now looking to me like a suspect, or at least, as the FBI would denote him 8 months later, a person of interest, unquote. When I lined up Hatfield's known movements with the postmarked locations of reported biothreats, those hoax anthrax attacks appeared to trail him like a vapor cloud. But in February 2002, shortly after I advanced his candidacy to my contact at FBI headquarters, I was told that Mr. Hatfield had a good alibi. A month later, when I pressed the issue, I was told, quote, look, Don, maybe you're spending too much time on this. unquote. Good people in the Department of Defense, the CIA, and the State Department, not to mention Bill Patrick, had vouched for Hatfield. I decided to give it a rest, but first I faxed a comparative handwriting sample to FBI headquarters with examples of Hatfield's printing on the left and printing by the anthrax offender on the right. I am not a handwriting expert, so I supplied the document without comment. A week later, I got a thank you call. In 1999, Hatfield was fired by the USAMRIID. He was then hired at Science Applications International Corporation, or SAIC, a contractor for the Department of Defense and the CIA, but he departed SAIC in March of 2002, a month after he took a polygraph confirming the anthrax matter that he says he passed. Hatfield at the time was building a mobile germ lab out of an old truck chassis, and after SAIC fired him, he continued work on it using his own money. When the FBI wanted to confiscate the mobile lab to test it for anthrax spores, the Army resisted, moving the trailer to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where it was used to train special forces in preparation for the war on Iraq. Those classes were taught by Steve Hatfield and Bill Patrick. Recall that in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, one of the supposed pieces of information were mobile germ laboratories that were run by Stephen Hatfield. That turned out to be disinformation from a disinformation agent named, I believe it was Softball, but it was disinformation, but, quote, mobile germ laboratories were one of the major justifications for the invasion of Iraq, continuing with Don Foster's article. In March of 2002, as the FBI continued to investigate, Hatfield moved on to a $150,000 a year job in Louisiana, funded by a grant from the Department of Justice. That same month, from Louisiana, came a fresh batch of hoax anthrax letters. LSU's Martin Hugh Jones, a World Health Organization director, examined the powder they contained and found it to be non-toxic. The letters were then put into a Xero file without their language being examined by a trained professional. On the night of March 12th of 2002, and this is at the same time that Hatfield moves to Louisiana. On the night of March 12th, Ayad Assad received a call from a person representing himself as a Louisiana FBI agent. The caller demanded to know if Assad had been told who wrote the Quantico letter. To prove his credentials, the caller rattled off personal information from as far back as Assad's Egyptian high school, the Arabic name of which he pronounced correctly. Assad believes he recognized the caller's source of information. He was likely reading from Assad's confidential SF-171, a U.S. government employment application form that had been on file at USAMRIID. Frightened, Dr. Assad hung up, then called me at home at 10 p.m. to tell me of the incident. I assured him the call was fraudulent. The FBI does not conduct its business in that way. There were, in my opinion, a few people whose recorded voices should be played back to Assad to see if he recognized one of them as his anonymous caller. Though it is a felony to impersonate an FBI agent, the task force decided not to investigate. According to Assad, when he finally called the FBI, he was told to get caller ID. In December of 2001, Dr. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg, a noted bioweapons expert, delivered a paper contending that the perpetrator of the anthrax crimes was an American microbiologist whose training and possession of AIMS strain powder pointed to a government insider with experience in the U.S. military lab. In March of 2002, she told the BBC that the anthrax deaths may have resulted from a secret project to examine the practicability of sending real anthrax through the mail, an experiment that misfired despite such precautions as taped envelope seals. The surprising hypothesis made Rosenberg a target for knee-jerk criticism, but competent sources within the biowarfare establishment thought she might well be right. In April, I met Ms. Rosenberg for lunch at an Indian, or I met Dr. Rosenberg for lunch at an Indian restaurant in Brewster, New York, and compared notes. We found that our evidence had led us in the same direction, though by different routes and for different reasons. The weeks dragged on. Prodded publicly by Dr. Rosenberg and privately by myself, the FBI's anthrax task force nevertheless seemed stubbornly unwilling to consider the evidence pointing toward a military insider or to examine the Quantico letter or those few, quote, hoax, unquote, biothreats that I believed and still believe may shed light on the anthrax murders. The additional documents that I had been expecting from the FBI never arrived. Special Agent Fitzgerald, the FBI's top in-house text analyst, asked to examine the same set of documents and received the same answer. No. I am not an insider, nor an old hand. I have worked with the FBI for only 6 years on no more than 20 investigations. But never have I encountered such reluctance to examine potentially critical documents. Meanwhile, friends of Fort Detrick were leaking to the press new pieces of disinformation indicating that the mailed anthrax probably came from Iraq. The leaks included false allegations that the Dashel anthrax included additives distinctive to the Iraqi arms program and that it had been dried using an atomizer spray dryer sold by Denmark to Iraq. Her patience exhausted, Dr. Rosenberg met with the Senate Judiciary Committee staff on June 18, 2002, and laid out the evidence such as it was hers and mine. Van Harp, head of the Amerithrax Task Force, sat in on the briefing. The senators were attentive, so too evidently was Harp. Exactly 1 week after Rosenberg's meeting with the Judiciary Committee staff, the FBI searched Hatfield's residence. A Bureau spokesman described it to the Washington Times as a, quote, voluntary search, unquote, without a warrant, quote, requested, unquote, by Dr. Hatfield to clear his name. Suddenly, I was flooded with documents from reporters and concerned scientists. Letters, emails, curricula vitae, handwriting samples, and original fiction by Stephen Hatfield. I learned from one document that Hatfield had audited a super terrorism seminar in Washington, D.C. on April 24, 1997, the same day as the B'nai B'rith incident. The next day, in a letter to the seminar's organizer, Edgar Brenner, he wrote that he was tremendously interested in becoming more involved in this area, unquote, and noted that the Petri dish scare so soon after the seminar showed that, quote, this topic is vital to the security of the U.S. Hatfield's original fiction included a cut-and-paste forgery of a diploma for a Ph.D. from Rhodes University, which he used to obtain his job at the NIH USAMRIID and SAIC. No less interesting to me as a professor of English literature was Hatfield's unpublished novel Emergence, which I examined in Washington at the U.S. Copyright Office. In the book, an Iraqi virologist launches a bioterror attack on behalf of an unnamed sponsor using an identity acquired from the Irish Republican Army and a homemade sprayer just like the one Stephen Hatfield demonstrated for the Washington Times. A fictional scientist named Stephen J. Roberts came to the rescue, tracing the outbreak to Iraq. The strange Lovian novel ends with America nuking Baghdad. As the warheads fall, the pilot remarks, "Beautiful, just beautiful. Welcome to F-blank-blank-blank city, ragheads. Let's get the hell out of Dodge." I was reminded of Bill Patrick's words in his talk at Maxwell Air Force Base. Quote, "The beauty of biological warfare, good people, is that you can pick an agent with a short period of incubation, or a moderate period of incubation, or a long period. And this, I think, would be very attractive to terrorists because they can do their dirty work and get out of Dodge City, and you won't know that you're infected till they're long gone," unquote. Hatfield's novel, however, has a surprise ending. In a 3-page epilogue, the narrator, a Russian mobster, reveals that his own organization, not Iraq, is responsible for the bioterror attack. The reaction was as great as we had hoped for. The entire focus of the American FBI has now shifted towards combating chemical and biological terrorism, and this is allowing us to formulate the unprecedented expansion of our organization. Biowarfare fiction was no mere lark for Stephen Hatfield. It was his specialty. His responsibilities at USAMRIID included the writing of bioterror scenarios, at least one of which actually happened. Hatfield envisioned someone spreading a pathogen throughout several floors of a public office building. It would take only one reported illness, he predicted, to shut down the entire building, especially if the bug had been sprayed on several floors. Then the call comes, quote, "Let our man loose, or we'll do a school," unquote. In August of 1998, in Wichita, Kansas, 14 miles southeast of Southwestern College, Hatfield's alma mater, powder was spread throughout several floors of the Finney State Office Building. Then came, quote, "the call," unquote, in the form of a letter from a team of Christian identity extremists and a group calling itself Brothers for Freedom of Americans, unquote. A few days later, Hatfield and Bill Patrick arrived in San Diego for the Worldwide Conference on Anti-Terrorism, sponsored by the U.S. Defense Department. I asked my FBI contact for the Wichita documents, and again, my requests were denied. The ink was hardly dry in emergence when the government hired Hatfield, now working for SAIC, to commission a paper from Bill Patrick focusing on how to respond to a biological terror event. I have read Patrick's 1999 report, Risk Assessment, unquote. Although it is a classified document, it contains little that he hasn't said before elsewhere. I did, however, find in it something that surprised me. Patrick, and again this is 1999, Patrick describes a hypothetical incident in which an attacker uses the U.S. mail service to deliver a business envelope containing no more than 2.5 grams of aerosolized anthrax refined to a trillion spores per gram in particles smaller than 5 microns. Patrick explains that 2.5 grams is the amount that could be placed into a standard envelope without detection. Quote, "more powder makes the envelope bulge and draws attention," unquote. As prophecies go, this 1999 one was right on the money. The Death to America letters sent 2 years later to Senators Daschle and Leahy contained about a gram of aerosolized anthrax, particle size 1 to 3 microns, refined to a trillion spores per gram. Bill Patrick, plus the Bugway scientists, make up Richard Spurtzel's short list of 4 U.S. experts who know how to make such a fine, dry powder. The anthrax killer, whoever he may be, represents a 5th expert with Patrick's bench skills. But until the Daschle powder appeared, every quoted expert I have seen except Patrick said that it could not be done at all. After rumors broke that Bill Patrick in a classified paper had foreseen a bioterror attack using the mail service, a transcript of his paper was leaked to the press. The leaked version represents Patrick's original text for SAIC, typos and all, but with one critical omission. A footnote in which Patrick claims that the U.S. has refined, quote, weaponized, unquote, power to a trillion spores per gram has disappeared. By midsummer, the FBI and even Attorney General John Ashcroft were obliged to call Stephen Hatfield a person of interest, unquote, despite diehard assurances from other government sources that he wasn't. That August, the FBI returned to Hatfield's Maryland apartment. Searching his refrigerator, agents found a canister of Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, a mostly harmless pesticide widely used on caterpillars, which USAMRIID adopted for study in 1995, after the United Nations discovered that BT was Iraq's favorite anthrax simulant. As for Hatfield, it was the FBI's best team of trained bloodhounds, not an offender profile or my text analysis, that finally persuaded the Amerithrax Task Force in July of 2002 to associate Hatfield with the anthrax letters and put him under 24-hour surveillance. The Bureau's description of him as a person of interest, unquote, is neither inaccurate nor unfair. Through his lawyer, Hatfield maintained his innocence and declined to comment for this article. Again, parenthetically, he was eventually acquitted, and the culpability for the anthrax attacks was pinned on Bruce Ivins, a Fort Detrick researcher who had conveniently committed suicide. Another conveniently dead, no nut. And the commentary here from Don Foster concludes, several of America's bioweaponeers have said for the record that the anthrax attack has an upside. The killings have forced long-awaited FDA approval of the Bioport anthrax vaccine facility and prompted increased federal spending on biodefense by $6 billion in 2003 alone. But the anthrax offender also diverted law enforcement resources when we needed them the most and wreaked havoc on the U.S. Postal Service. He has shown the world how to disrupt the American economy with minimal expense and how to kill with minimal risk of being caught. Now that it's been done, it seems likely to happen again. And noting from an article we have used before, from Newsweek magazine of December 5th of 2007, High Stakes Science, unquote, by Jenwen, J-E-N-W-E-N, Interlandi, I-N-T-E-R-L-A-N-D-I, noting how the anthrax attacks led to a tenfold increase of spending for biological warfare. Before the anthrax mailings of 2001, the U.S. had just two BSL-4 labs, both within the razor wire confines of government-owned campuses. Now, thanks to a tenfold increase in funding from $200 million in 2001 to $2 billion in 2006, more than a dozen such facilities can be found at universities and private companies across the country. Some scientists say that argument obscures this, that these are civilian facilities. But some scientists say that argument obscures the true purpose of the current biodefense boom, to study potential biological weapons. Quote, the university, that's Boston University, the university portrays it as an emerging infectious disease lab, said David Ozanoff, O-Z-O-N-O-F-F, a Boston University epidemiologist whose office is right across the street from the new BSL-4 facility. But they are talking about studying things like smallpox and inhalation anthrax that pose no public health threat other than as bioweapons. The original NIH mandate for the lab indicated that many groups, including the CIA and Department of Defense, would be allowed to use the lab for their own research, the nature of which BU might have little control over. Now note that while this tenfold increase in spending following the 2001 anthrax attacks was going on, and the anthrax attacks having served to help justify the invasion of Iraq, the head of the Defense Department, Secretary of Defense, was Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld had been chairman of the board for Gilead Sciences, and then resigned and took his position as Secretary of Defense in 2001. And recall something that we looked at in our last program from CNN of October 31st of 2005, article by Nelson B. Schwartz, Rumsfeld's growing stake in Tamiflu. And this, once more the federal government is emerging as one of the world's biggest customers for Gilead Sciences' Tamiflu. In July, the Pentagon ordered $58 million worth of the treatment for U.S. troops around the world, and Congress is considering a multi-million dollar purchase. And from The Independent of March 12th of 2006, Donald Rumsfeld makes $5 million killing on bird flu drug. The firm made a loss in 2000. I'm going to summarize this due to lack of time. But Donald Rumsfeld made $5 million in selling stock in Gilead Sciences, which made a whole lot of money after developing Tamiflu to combat the predicted H5N1 avian flu epidemic that never actually took place. And note as well, again, that he had been chairman of the board of Gilead Sciences. Now, note something else in his Wikipedia article, or actually in the Strategic Studies blog. It's noted that Donald, and you can also read this in his Wikipedia entry, Donald Rumsfeld was one of the signatories to a letter sent by the Project for a New American Century to Bill Clinton in 1998 to toughen his stance on Iraq. And note, closing with what we began from the Last American Vagabond article by Whitney Webb, speaking of PNAC, I think it is arguably the think tank's most In what is arguably the think tank's most controversial document titled Rebuilding America's Defenses, there are a few passages to openly discuss the utility of bioweapons, including the following sentences. Combat likely will take place in new dimensions, in space, cyberspace, and perhaps the world of microbes, advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes, may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. And again, note that Donald Rumsfeld sent a letter, one of the signatories to PNAC's letter to Bill Clinton in 1998, advocating a tougher stance toward Iraq. This concludes For the Record program number 1139, the 2001 anthrax attacks, the expansion of biological warfare capabilities, and the invasion of Iraq. This is being recorded on July 13th of 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.